after that, my guess is you'll never hear from him again. The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
Welcome to Now Playing Podcast Review of The Usual Suspects.
There is no Kaiser Soze.
Who is Kaiser Soze?
A patron-exclusive review chosen by Sean Ray.
My employer requires your services, gentlemen. One job, one day's work. Very dangerous.
Hosted by Arnie.
A lot of guys equate him to that reporter on The Incredible Hulk.
Stuart.
That guy is tense. Tension is a killer.
And Jacob.
You don't put guys like that into a room together. Who knows what can happen?
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
He was my partner for 5 years. We did more jobs, and I saw more money than you can ever count. So fuck you!
We hope you enjoy the show.
But Keith,
it was Kaiser Soze, Agent Kuyan. I mean the devil himself. How do you shoot the devil in the back? What if you miss?
Today we're discussing The Usual Suspects, starring Stephen Baldwin, Gabriel Byrne, Chaz Palminteri, Kevin Pollak, Pete Postlethwaite, Kevin Spacey, Benicio Del Toro, directed by Bryan Singer. Afternoon, my little pork chops. This is the Now Playing co-host that'll flip ya for real, Arnie.
And Stuart.
And this is the co-host that will fuck your father in the shower and then have a snack, Jacob.
Well, happy November.
We're finally here. It's been how many years we've been doing Now Playing, and finally we're covering The Usual Suspects. Probably something I've been wanting to cover since 2007.
This has got to be like number two after Real Genius.
I don't know. It doesn't come up as much, but yes, I did know that you were a big fan of this, and you were not alone. I mean, this is one that always floats to the top of the list when you're talking about great movies of the 90s, greatest movies of all time, greatest crime movies. This is a lot of people's favorite.
And it is a favorite of Sean Ray, our supporter who actually picked this movie and enabled us to review it.
Yeah, why did he want to do it? Other than, you know, he just co-signs on what everyone else says. Great noir film.
He said that until a few years ago, Kevin Spacey was one of his favorite actors. We'll talk about what may have changed there. And he says this is arguably Spacey's best performance. And he says this is one of the few films that he thinks works even after you know the twist. It's not just about the twist. It's not like a Shyamalan film where you watch it once and then you're done with it. So, and that I'm the one bringing in the Shyamalan. He didn't bring in Shyamalan. So he wanted to hear our thoughts on it.
Sometimes you don't even watch Shyamalan once.
So thanks to Sean Ray for picking this movie. As Stuart said, I am a longtime fan of The Usual Suspects. Didn't see it in theaters. I'm not even sure it came to Springfield where I was living at the time. It only opened on, at its widest, about 800 screens in the U.S. But when it was new on video, I saw the box. I'd heard about the film. It had won a couple of Oscars. So I rented it when it was a new release and instantly became enamored with this, invited friends over to watch it the very next day because I was so loving of the twist and wanted to rewatch the film knowing the secrets. I even had a box set of VHS for this. I never had a Laserdisc player until the 21st century, but this was the movie that introduced me to the concept of a movie commentary. They released the commentary on Laserdisc, which was common. They released the commentary on VHS. You had one VHS tape that was the movie, letterboxed, nice. Then you had a second VHS tape that was the movie with a commentary by Bryan Singer and Christopher McQuarrie. And so it was the very first time I'd ever even heard of the commentary happening, the first time I'd heard filmmakers talk over their own movie. And then I also got a nice little, like, who is Kaiser Soze button. And they actually included a lighter, a functional lighter in this little VHS box set, if you can imagine. So this was a seminal movie for my love of movies. I am just so giddy to be here.
I could tell.
Yes. Well, I'm going to prove Sean Ray wrong. I saw this movie once. And that was enough. I enjoyed it. It had the misfortune of coming out in 1995, which was both a year saturated with Tarantino wannabes. I was in film school. All my classmates were making Tarantino wannabe films. Every time I went to the theater, it was a new noir. And yeah, I remember this one feeling like it was better than the average, but I enjoyed it. It was a summer film. It felt like a snack, and I didn't think about it again until it won, yeah, best screenplay, best supporting actor, and I was a little surprised at that. But yeah, I hadn't really thought about the film again. I'm actually anxious to come back, knowing that we look at both Bryan Singer and Kevin Spacey very differently. Maybe it's easier to guess the twist now, because we think of them in different ways.
And this is one I've wanted to come back and revisit as well. I've only seen it once. I saw it around 2000, a few years after it had come out. I had heard good things about it, decided to check it out. And I guess I am the skeptic on this show, because if you would have asked me before this rewatch, just my initial reaction when you say The Usual Suspects, it would have been negative. I remember that twist and really disliking it, and just kind of scoffed whenever anyone would bring up how great this film was. I really disliked it, but sometimes that's a you thing. And so I've always wanted to come back to this one and revisit it, but just hadn't had the chance until now.
Do you think it might have been the hype? I definitely know for me, it was like, I liked the film, and then when everyone was like, it's the best movie of all time, I'm like, meh.
It was only recommended by one friend who said, oh, this is a really good film, you should check it out. We'll talk about it when we get to the ending. I had a real problem with that ending the first time I watched it. And you know what? When you're watching a movie just for leisure, you're not always paying the most attention. So who knows what was going on? But yes, initially coming in, I'm like, oh, this is one of those overrated films that everyone, they love that twist. And that's all there is to it. That was one of my questions coming back to this film. Is there more than the twist?
I think there is. I mean, I watched this film a ton. Not just first time with the commentary, not just with friends. This one was in heavy rotation. The DVD came out. It was one of my first DVDs that I purchased and watched it on there. In the 90s, I probably watched this movie 30 times, maybe more.
Okay, so big fan.
Yeah, and what's interesting to me is that I haven't watched it in probably 20 years or so. It has been a long time since I watched it. I was really happy. There's a 4K remastered release of this that came out that I picked up when it was new. So I was happy to be able to watch it and see the new scan of the film and see it better than I've ever seen it before. But will I still love this movie when I come back to it 20 years later? Will it hold up, or do I just have such good memories of it? Can it not actually live up when I put the now playing glasses on and actually go in to critique the film?
Well, there's one thing that's unassailable. It was the film that made Kevin Spacey a superstar. Love him or hate him, he was everywhere in 1995. He was in Outbreak, small role, goofy role, but then he was the killer in Seven, and then, yeah, he was in this movie, gets the Oscar, goes on Time to Kill, L.A. Confidential. I felt like he would pop up in everything in the 90s. And then, of course, after House of Cards, yeah, it all fell like a house of cards.
What's funny is I pretty much only knew Kevin Spacey from the Dennis Leary movie The Ref when I was watching this. And yeah, this and Seven I watched in pretty close proximity, and it gave me a totally different view of Kevin Spacey. Now, I'd seen Kevin Spacey in stuff like L.A. Confidential. I saw that in theaters, but I didn't remember him. He didn't make an impression on me until these two movies, Seven and Usual Suspects.
Yeah, the first time he made an impression on me, I'd seen other films with him, I'm sure, but the first time was American Beauty. So maybe it was always set up that he was the creep. And Bryan Singer, too, directing this. I'm glad there's no young men in this cast.
Yeah, stories now have come out that their bad behavior goes all the way back to The Usual Suspects. The two even had a falling out over Kevin Spacey making moves on Bryan Singer's very young boyfriend, and things like that are coming out. This is one, again, where you have to separate the art from the artist, right? Both of them have been canceled at this point. I don't see them digging their way back.
He just got a standing ovation talking about cancel culture. I don't know how canceled Kevin is.
Well, you can get applause for standing up to it, but there will still be people booing you.
That's not cancel culture. That's you being a pervert and getting called out on it.
there's a mark on both their careers. And I believe even Bryan Singer has suffered more. Like, he really has stopped working.
He did Jack the Giant Slayer. He should suffer.
And, I mean, he didn't even show up for Bohemian Rhapsody for half that film. I think he has bigger problems career-wise than just his personal proclivities. I think he has a bad work ethic.
No, those things can be intertwined. I'll leave it at that. But worth pointing out, this is not Singer's first film. It's often thought of as his breakout. One wonders what his career might have been had he gone down this noir path. He, of course, is mostly what we've talked about is his work in the superhero genre. But he had already kind of done a noir, a little film called Public Access. You guys ever hear of it?
Nope.
I heard about it on the commentary and things. It's how they got Kevin Spacey for this film. As Kevin Spacey saw Public Access and told Bryan Singer, what are you working on next? I'd love to work in one of your films after seeing Public Access. But I have not seen Public Access.
Yeah, it's intriguing. It's hard to find. I tried to rewatch it and it's not streaming anywhere. But I don't know, back, 20 years ago when I had the Sundance Channel or something, I was able to catch one viewing of it. And it's kind of like a warm-up for Kaiser Sose. It's this master manipulator who seduces a whole town. And basically, he gets on, I don't know if people even know what a public access channel is, but PBS lets common folk come into the TV studio and air kind of pathetic programming.
Public access is great. I love that when that was a cable thing.
Think podcasts before there were podcasts. Instead of being on a podcast and people downloaded you, you'd actually go into like a local college TV studio and be broadcast on local channels.
Just weirdos.
Yeah, this guy basically starts airing town gossip and getting people to reveal things about themselves on this channel, and it becomes this weird funhouse mirror of small town life. It was interesting. It wasn't a great film, but I definitely think, oh, what will that guy do next? And I wouldn't imagine it would be X-Men or Superman Returns. I mean, Bryan Singer in the 90s looked like he was going to follow the path of Quentin Tarantino.
Well, I mean, after this, he did Apt Pupil. There was that middle step there where he was stepping kind of out of noir, but staying in a thriller sense before he got tapped to do X-Men. Kind of a strange pick. He had nothing on his resume that makes you think, that guy needs to do my superhero movie.
It's because nobody was doing superhero movies that I think he stepped into that vacuum. And of course, he didn't do this alone. A lot of the credit and the Oscar went to screenwriter Christopher McQuarrie, who now I think is thought of as Tom Cruise's go-to for script doctor and even director.
He and Bryan Singer went to high school together. So they were old friends. I think they both worked together on Public Access. I kind of saw them as a duo, especially since, again, my first commentary ever, and they were on it as good friends. I kind of thought they would be a pair forever. I thought it would be his scripts and Singer's directing. But if I had to pick one that I'm a greater fan of, I think I like Christopher McQuarrie more than I like Bryan Singer, the body of work as well as the person.
I'd have to look at a side-by-side, but it definitely seems like McQuarrie is obviously, certainly, now that he's helming big, expensive Mission Impossible movies, doing much better than his best friend, former best friend, whatever they are. Everybody else in this cast is actually maybe a reason why I didn't really loved the movie like other people loved. I felt like there was a lot of, like, lightweights here. Stephen Baldwin, that's the Baldwin you never want to see.
Yeah, this cast does feel like it's a big ensemble, and I don't know, Benicio del Toro's a thing now, but he looks like a baby in this, he's so young.
He was the breakout. He was the one in the cast that I loved. Of the five suspects, he is my favorite.
Easily the best.
Oh, yeah, he was my favorite back then, too. You know, I was at a press junket for Guardians of the Galaxy before Guardians came out. And so Chris Pratt was there. I never watched Parks and Rec, so I'm like, who's this guy? They had Zoe Saldana. I'm like, okay, it's the woman from Star Trek. Uhura is here. And then Benicio del Toro came out. I'm like, oh my God, it's Fenster! I'm in the same room as Fenster! I'm freaking out!
Yeah, he's a lot of fun. Even now, I would say he's still my favorite. But the rest of them, yeah, it just didn't have, when you compare it to like a Tarantino, who delights in bringing people out of the mothballs, like Pam Grier or John Travolta, this cast just feels like people that should stay in mothballs for the most part.
This is surprising because one of the things that drew me to this film was the cast. And I only knew Kevin Spacey, as I said, from The Ref, but Kevin Pollak. I watched him do stand-up in the early 90s. He was always on the stand-up shows I watched. He was really good in A Few Good Men, which I had seen. So he was a draw. Stephen Baldwin, I liked his performance in Threesome, and I thought that he had a real cool aura about him in this film. The one I didn't know at all was Gabriel Byrne, and he was the lead of the film. But everybody else in this film was kind of like, yeah, I sort of know those actors. Chaz Palminteri, for example. And I was drawn to this a lot because of the cast on the poster.
Yeah, they're a very macho cast, but I, again, how convincing are they? Stephen Baldwin, oof, wince, well, pain. Kevin Pollak, wincing. They're not really go-to actors, certainly not now.
Kevin Pollak is literally one of the top five funniest stand-ups I've ever seen in person. He is an incredible mimic.
But this is a crime thriller. Why do you want a stand-up comic?
Yeah, maybe not a great fit for him here.
He's great in this movie, though. He is perfectly cast. This entire ensemble plays so well off each other by having these different flavors of actors.
Okay, well, let's get into it then. That sounds like an invitation to describe this plot as best you can and find out about these usual and unusual suspects.
Well, The Usual Suspects is told in flashback as Verbal Kint, played by Kevin Spacey, is being interrogated by Agent Dave Kuyan, played by Chaz Palminteri. Verbal was one of the only two survivors of a boat robbery gone incredibly wrong. Over 20 people are dead, the supposed cocaine was not found, and Verbal has somehow been granted immunity for his involvement. But Agent Kuyan is most interested in a criminal named Dean Keaton, played by Gabriel Byrne. Keaton supposedly died in the fire, but Kuyan is unconvinced. So this is the story Verbal tells. Five criminals were arrested in New York City for a truck hijacking. They are Keaton, Verbal, then Fenster, played by Benicio del Toro, McManus, played by Stephen Baldwin, and Hockney, played by Kevin Pollak. These five guys together hatched a plan to rob emeralds from crooked NYPD cops, which they do. They then fly to LA to sell the emeralds to the Fence, who has another job for the crew. This job is to steal jewels and cash, but it goes wrong. All the targets are killed, and there's no jewels or cash, only a briefcase of cocaine. It turns out that second job was a setup arranged by a lawyer named Kobayashi, played by Pete Postlewaite. Kobayashi works for the infamous and mysterious drug kingpin, Kaiser Soze. Each of the five criminals had inadvertently stolen from Soze through their careers, and now Soze wants payback, or revenge. Kobayashi tells the five criminals they can do a high-risk job for Soze, or they'll all be killed. Fenster tries to run for it and is killed. The remaining four decide to do the job. Supposedly, the job is to invade an incoming boat and destroy a lot of cocaine owned by one of Soze's competitors. There will also be $93 million in cash to be paid for the cocaine, and the criminals can keep it if they survive. They attack the people on the boat but find no cocaine. The boat wasn't actually transporting drugs, it was transporting a prisoner, one who knew Kaiser Soze's true identity and was going to spill it to the authorities. Soze is on the boat and shoots the informant in the head. He also kills Hockney, McManus, and, eventually, Keaton. He sets the boat on fire and walks away. Verbal survived because he wasn't on the boat. Keaton had told the cerebral palsy-afflicted Verbal to stay on land and get the money to Keaton's girlfriend if Keaton doesn't survive. Verbal tells all this to Kuan, who says Keaton was Kaiser Soze, and that Keaton didn't really die on the boat, he faked his own death. Verbal is let go, but Kuan says he's likely marked for death by Soze. But as Verbal leaves the police station, Kuyan finds out the truth. The other boat survivor, badly burned, gave a description of Soze. Verbal is Kaiser Soze, and he walked right out of the police station and into Kobayashi's waiting car as credits roll. And speaking of credits, these opening credits are really old school, aren't they? A long panning shot of still water, the names in alphabetical order popping up on screen, John Ottman's amazing score, the only thing we have to focus on. I'm so used to modern credits now where something is constantly happening and the titles just are inobtrusive in the corner or something. To just have basically an overture to open this film, I thought was refreshingly old.
It's very 90s. There's no doubt about it. You've already mentioned the idea of having an ensemble cast playing tough guys. And yeah, just here when we get started, the non-chronology that we're going to first establish this boat heist gone wrong and then jump around in time, keep the audience on the edge of their seat for the first 15 minutes. It is just the games that we were so in love with back in the mid-90s when Tarantino and so many others were playing with time.
I'll say, even though I had seen this, I didn't remember a whole lot about the plot. So I was very surprised. I saw Gabriel Byrne get that first listing in the cast. You're saying it's because it's alphabetical, but I'm like, oh, this is like their big get. And then he gets killed like at the beginning. I'm like, oh, that's weird. He got first billing when he's off right away. But yeah, we'll jump back 6 weeks and we'll go back and forth throughout this. Yeah, feels very Tarantino, what was in vogue back then.
Actually, I was shocked. The reason I realized it was alphabetical, the top name is Stephen Baldwin. I'm like, in what world does Stephen Baldwin get top billing for this movie? And then I realized it's because he comes before Byrne.
Yeah, I must have just ignored that one and noticed Gabriel Byrne, because why would Stephen Baldwin get first billing?
And then the filmmakers were kind of depressed because a lot of people called this movie a Pulp Fiction ripoff because of the non-chronology and being gangster and everything. This film had actually sat in the can for over a year and was made probably about the same time as Pulp Fiction. Now, that doesn't mean this isn't a Reservoir Dogs ripoff, yeah. But it's not a Pulp Fiction ripoff.
Yes, I was just about to say that. I definitely feel like Reservoir Dogs, obviously, with the idea of this group of guys and they're all going to get whacked, very much an influence.
And I loved Reservoir Dogs, one of my favorite movies in the 90s. Hopefully you've donated and heard a review of that film. And so I was in for all the Tarantino wannabes of the 90s and the crime films and Get Shorty, another film I really hope we can review someday. Although that means we have to review Be Cool, not so good about. But
never seen that one. Yeah.
Nope.
I do like Get Shorty.
But I think that's one of the reasons why I took to this film so quickly when I did.
Yeah, it was trendy. Again, 1995, this movie embodies it. And it's weird to think it wasn't this big hit. I almost feel like you needed a better producer. It came out on Gramercy Pictures. If it had been a Miramax, if they had actually had the devil produce this film, I bet you it would have made the $100 million that Seven and Pulp Fiction did. But this thing, yeah, it wasn't big in the time, but in the rentals that followed, I think that's where it gained its reputation.
It also was a cheap film to make, only a $6 million budget. I mean, this is an independent production through and through, and that it made 10 times its budget and started so many careers. I mean, all the actors we talked about, really, this launched so many careers. Bryan Singer's career, Christopher McQuarrie's career, Benicio del Toro credits this as the start of his career. Kevin Spacey includes this as one of the things that started his career.
Okay, yeah, I agree with all of those. There's a lot of people that get left behind, but yes, all right. Certainly, what we see as we're getting started here is McQuarrie specifically is laying a lot of clues and leaving a lot of evidence for you to assemble what you think is going on. I believe a good working theory you're going to have is if you see Gabriel Byrne, the star of the movie, get killed by someone whose face we do not see, you might be thinking, just as Chaz Palminteri is thinking, they're one in the same. That this story will eventually reveal that Kaiser Soze is not the assassin of Dean Keaton, but in fact, Dean Keaton.
I'll admit, the first time I watched this movie, I didn't think it was a whodunit. I just thought we weren't going to see this face for stylistic reasons. I never thought it was Dean Keaton until Chaz Palminteri's character, Kuyan, puts that forward. I never thought Kaiser Soze was one of the usual suspects. I didn't think I was watching an Agatha Christie-type mystery. So when the twist comes that it was one of them, out of the blue for me the first time I saw it.
And I'll offer, you don't know Gabriel Byrne, who at that time had largely done Irish films. He had been the star of the Coen brothers' Miller's Crossing. I always feel guilty that I don't like him more. I know he's a good actor, and yet there's just something kind of, I don't know. I watched In Treatment, and he's just so depressed in that story. He has such low energy. There's something about him that's just kind of a drag to watch. And so I just don't enjoy him as my lead actor ever.
I would say that means he kind of fits for this film, because I feel like there's great ideas here. Now get better people to do it.
Yeah, I would go ahead and say that. I feel like just about anybody could improve this cast. This cast is, with the exception of Benicio and Spacey, a lower register of noir tough guy.
I will agree that they aren't master thespians, but I think they work perfectly for this film. In the roles which they are given, they bring exactly what is needed to this to create an ensemble cast that works well together instead of just having a star. I would change not one person in this cast.
Okay, that's fair. Anyway, we're going to have, yes, the death off screen. It should be said, Kaiser Sose lifts the gun. Bang, bang. We don't see the bullets go into Gabriel Byrne. Again, I think that's a good working theory to have. If you think he's a lead, why would you kill him in the beginning? Yes, we'll have two different investigations that dovetail. First, we'll see Giancarlo Esposito at this boat dock the next morning. The ship is still on fire. The bodies are all charred. He's counting. He's trying to figure out everything. And he knows that there is one survivor he's going to follow to the hospital and try to get a story from. That's a Hungarian that you might believe. This is what I mean about the screenwriter being crafty. They cut to a shot of a body floating in the harbor. And then later we have a character that says they just pulled a body out of the harbor. And it's this Hungarian coming in. You might think they're one and the same. You won't realize that until you work the story through and through that this body is somebody else and very important to the actual mystery. More than the Hungarian, frankly.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in dialogue here that is said, not shown, that I think it took me several watchings to really follow what's going on with the Hungarian, what's going on with the body they pull out of the drain pipe, who is everybody involved, what is this backstory that we're going to get into later on. This film is very layered, and I think benefits the more often you watch it, you'll keep catching new things, but it's a really tightly written script. I dare say as tight as Back to the Future. You know, every line matters and everything ties together.
But obscures as well. At the same time that there are connective tissues, I feel like nobody just says, yeah, the suspect came in. They give a whole litany about his race, ethnicity, the time of day, how many weeks ago. There's too much information, particularly for a first viewing, for you to hold on to the story that's being told, which is the game, of course, is that reliable narrators. How can I follow this story? It's jumping around between different people saying different things, and I think they're talking about the same thing, but turns out they're not. And the main story being told, of course, is the fact that Chaz Palminteri's New York customs inspector is blowing in to catch Keaton. He wants Gabriel Byrne. That's really all he cares about. Tell me this guy is dead. Show me his body. I don't believe it. And he knows that this one living suspect that's not a Hungarian in a coma might be able to tell him yes or no. And most of the movie comes out of him grilling verbal Kent.
And there's so much that we get through dropped dialogue here. Before this interrogation even begins, we get one shot of verbal being interrogated with like a light above his head, and then something about him being protected by on high, that Verbal's lawyer came in and somehow got him immunity for everything. He has a misdemeanor weapons charge coming out of all this, but other than that, complete immunity. And how did this happen? But it's, again, it's so glossed over. It's said, but so much is said, it's hard to pay attention to that on one viewing. And it may, though, later on repeat viewings, you go, oh yeah, well, this guy has strings he can pull because he's Kaiser Soze.
Yeah, and I think that was one of my problems the first time I watched this. There is a lot going on, and if you're not fully paying attention, you're just going to miss a lot of stuff. Like, even watching it this time, when Verbal's introduced and he's got immunity and all this stuff, I'm like, the way Spacey is playing him, that Verbal is written, he's got this gimp leg, you know, he doesn't seem like he's the brightest, but I don't know, he is one of these high-level suspects that they're always bringing in for some reason. But I'm just like, it doesn't quite work out, like, who this character is versus what we're being told. Now, we're going to find that out at the end, but yeah, there's so much going on, it's very easy to get lost in it.
But one of the lines that sticks out, at least for me, is that he's being protected by the Prince of Darkness. Horror, Satan. We had just watched Angel Heart. And again, I see a kinship, a real kinship between these movies and the way that they like to pepper in to their noir elements of the horror villain. That idea that Satan is here and maybe just protecting this little guy. Now, this guy couldn't possibly be a master criminal because look at him, you know, and the way that he's going to affect his gimp and
that haircut.
Yes, exactly. He is. It's how he's a con man, of course. So a lot of this is affectation. But if you believe it and you don't have much reference for Kevin Spacey, a lot of people didn't in 1995, you might think that he looks like the most innocent one of the five suspects when they all get called in to a police lineup in New York.
I love this introduction to the characters. We are introduced to them as they get arrested. It's a montage. When we get to Benicio, who is just such a scene stealer in this, steel drums come into the score. It immediately gives you some kind of focus on the Fenster character, but we never see Verbal get arrested. You said, Jacob, that Verbal doesn't seem like he'd belong there. That's even one of the lines of dialogue, is Verbal saying, "I didn't belong there with these tough guys." Verbal is a con man. The others are hijackers, thieves, things like that. So that he would be one of these five is unlikely. He would be the usual suspect.
It's also why Chaz Palminteri thinks he can lean on him. Instantly, he pulls him into this room. The guy has immunity, so he's like, "I don't really need to tell you anything." Well, this cop is going to be like, "I can tell all the criminals, you leak their names. All the immunity in the world won't protect you from the criminal underworld. You're going to get whacked unless you tell me what you know." And that's ostensibly why this little weakling is going to recite how they all came together for a job. They met by coincidence because the cops just thought maybe any of them could be the person that ripped off a truck full of arms, but they quickly make an opportunity out of this. It is Stephen Baldwin who suggests they do a job together.
And I don't know if people catch this. It is revealed later that it was Kevin Pollak who ripped off the gun truck. So it was one of them.
Yeah, strangely enough, Del Toro is the one that's like, "Who took our truck?" But yeah, he's not working with Pollak. And Pollak, yes, will be revealed. All those weapons were supposed to go. Kaiser was moving them to arm Belfast. And Kevin Pollak screwed that up, which is why they're all here. They don't know it yet, but they've been selected as people that owe a Prince of Darkness gangster a job. But they think they're making up the job. That's Stephen Baldwin suggesting, "Let's rip off a jewel smuggler."
And he's doing that while they're in prison. What do you guys think of their interplay here? Because the lineup scene, where they're having to read that line to the police and they're all cracking up and smacking each other and just kind of having a good time, and then all in this jail cell together, getting to know each other. Benicio del Toro affecting this mumble where you can barely understand what he's saying. Instantly, the first time I saw this movie, these were the two scenes, the lineup scene and the we're in jail together scene, made me love these guys and love them as a crew.
I'll agree with you on the lineup scene. I mean, that is the poster. That's one of the big scenes that always stuck out to me. Like, I think that's a good introduction, but then when they're in the cell, that's when you got to solidify this crew, and I feel like that's where this falls short. Maybe it's the writing, maybe it's the caliber of actor. There are times in this film where the blocking and staging feels very obvious, almost to where the point where I'm like, was this based off of a stage play? Because the way they're moving is so deliberate, and maybe if they had, I don't know, more natural, better actors, it wouldn't have felt like that so much, but I like this crew. I wish I liked it more. I wish there was a debate about a Madonna song and tipping or something to really pull me into this crowd. Besides Benicio del Toro, I don't get a whole lot of personality from the rest.
I'm just going to use the word posturing. A lot of what I see happening here are people pretending to be tough. And by contrast, to look at Reservoir Dogs, you just mentioned it, Jacob. That's a movie that demystifies gangsters and shows that they listen to Madonna songs and, yeah, have soft sides. Here, I just feel, particularly with Stephen Baldwin, Like, they've really all just hoped that they get more work out of this. They want to look so cool.
Baldwin is like a super gunman in this. Like, he can hit any target. Doesn't matter if they're holding a hostage. That did feel weird. I'm like, this feels like it should be a little bit more grounded and that he's not like this expert marksman just taking everyone out.
And I've said on recent podcasts like The Expendables and things how much I love a sniper in a movie. And so I loved Baldwin's character in this, thinking he's just this badass marksman. We're going to see at one point with two pistols, one in each hand, he shoots two people with absolute accuracy. I just loved a character that was that skillful with weapons.
Yeah, Tarantino could do that, but this isn't a Tarantino film. So it feels weird to me when he pulls off that move.
I would say that there are two actors in this group, and then there are three character actors in this group. And Benicio del Toro is a wonderful character actor. All of his mumbles, you can't anticipate his line readings. That just, yeah, he keeps you leaning in to try and follow where his mind is at, what he's doing. He's a great character actor. I don't mind that he's not a complicated character. But the rest of them, yeah, Kevin Pollak and Stephen Baldwin particularly look in over their head. I see sweat on their brow of them trying to look cooler than they are.
Oh, wow. I think Kevin Pollak does so well here, especially given that I knew him as a stand-up comic, that he can play some of the dramatic beats he does in this movie.
Like what?
The scene where Fenster is found dead on the beach and Kevin Pollak is ready to disavow the crew, he really channels an anger in his performance that I wouldn't have thought capable of him. But most of the movie, he's the funny one, and that's what you want a stand-up comic for. I like that all of these guys are bringing a different energy, and Kevin Pollak is sardonic. He's sarcastic. I really enjoy what he brings to it. I understand Stephen Baldwin, I think he does great in this, but he's a nothing actor and probably could be easily replaced with a million different actors. But I wouldn't trade Kevin Pollak in this film for anything, the humor he brings to the role.
I don't think he's funny. I think Del Toro's funny. I don't think he's funny at all. But the soul, the person we're to care about, again, we'll get the sad guy, Gabriel Byrne. Like, he just always depresses me whenever I see him, that low energy. And it's a cliche, right? Like, he's trying to inhabit the cliche of the criminal that's trying to go straight, but doing one last job. It can be done. I've seen actors tackle it with various levels of success. Here, I don't really feel for him. And for a complicated bunch of reasons, I just don't care whether he goes straight or not.
Because he's such a sad sack, I buy it. Because he's not got the same energy as these other actors, I see him as the reluctant criminal. What I don't get off of him is ex-cop. And I think the performance he's given, it's fine criminal trying to go straight, but what we're told is he used to be NYPD, and that he was a corrupt cop who got indicted while being a cop, who then became this master criminal, who then now is trying to become a restaurateur.
And has head-fucked a lawyer that probably used to is bailing him out right now of crimes, but really believes she loves him. I mean, that, again, you want to see a manipulator. You want to believe he has Kaiser Soze powers to pull strings and make things happen. And I agree. I just feel like this guy is too depressing, too sad, too slow to have that kind of edge.
See, and I was thinking as I was watching this, now I knew who Kaiser Soze was the second time around, but paying attention to Keaton, Gabriel Byrne's character, yeah, he is such a sad sack and he's kind of quiet, yet he's always in control. I could see like how, yeah, they molded him to throw you off the trail of who Kaiser Soze is to try to get you to buy into that ending with Q-On when he thinks he's figured it all out.
Let me be clear. All these people are good enough, but only Del Toro and maybe Spacey is great. Only those two are ones that I want to watch. The rest of them, I'm watching.
I'm not going to say any of these performances are bad. I'm saying this could be a lot better. For this kind of an ensemble cast, you want all like actors are going to knock this out of the park for this kind of film, especially in 1995.
It could be a lot deeper, is the word I want to use. This is a very superficial, surface movie, and there's not a whole lot to these caricatures.
Well, that was one of the surprises when they're in jail. I thought we'd figure out more about them, and I never really know that much about them except Keaton. that he used to be a cop and he has a background, but I don't know a whole lot about anyone else.
No, we're not going to get that. And I'll agree that individual performances here aren't as strong as I feel the ensemble is. And I think that the chemistry between these actors is actually more important than a specific actor's performance.
I do like the idea that you get a bunch of criminals in one jail cell together and they're actually going to hatch a crime. It's a good hook.
Yeah, no, this is a great conceit.
Yeah, I like this hook that, okay, so busting it down, McManus, Baldwin, he knows a cop who is running a corrupt cop Uber. There's like a whole service where cops will shuttle you around. I think they say $300 a mile. They'll let you get away with your crime. In this case, a smuggler that needs a ride from the airport to I don't even know where. You'd think you could take a normal taxi. But I guess he wants protection because he's holding $3 million worth of jewels.
I just took an Uber from LaGuardia to Midtown, and I felt like I had to hand over a big envelope of cash. It costs that much with tolls and everything. So I think these days, you're getting off cheap with what he's paying.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so this is the job that they could come in there, and McManus being McManus, we can just kill them all and take the loot and take the money, and that's the job. I think, for lots of reasons, Keaton is not into that. He is trying to be legit. We saw that when he was arrested, he's trying to position himself as a restaurateur to French investors. He wants to be big in New York, and that means not looking like a gangster. And so, not interested in this until Verbal Kent comes to him and makes him feel guilty, makes him punch him, and then he's like, oh, I hurt you, I guess I can do it for you. I don't want you to suffer.
I feel like Verbal convinced him by repeatedly saying, I know a way to do this without shooting, without the violence. And again, I don't know how much Kaiser Soze is planning to put this group together and that he needs Keaton because he knows Q-On has this bias or whatever. But I definitely feel like watching this now, knowing the twist, I'll agree with you, Arnie. It's a more rewarding experience. I like seeing all these plays going on where not everyone has all the information and they might not know why someone's saying something and all that. I think it makes this a better film. So yeah, I definitely see Verbal as the one getting Keaton on board because he's like, I know another way to do this and we don't have to do it that way.
I mean, let's get real. If you just need to whack somebody that can ID you, there are simpler ways to do it than to assemble this team in New York and have them fumble their way to an L.A. boat. This is needlessly convoluted for Kaiser Soze to do.
But did Kaiser actively arrange them to rob these emeralds? Or was this just a happenstance of bringing the people together?
I felt like he's the one putting this together.
Yes. They all have robbed him. It is no coincidence that they are all on that lineup that gets set.
No, I understand that, but the fact that they robbed these emeralds, I don't know if Kaiser saw that coming.
I feel like because he knows he has a plan to do it nonviolently that, like, yeah, he had a hand in this.
Yes. McManus may think it's his idea, but chances are it was planted by this little guy in the corner that you're just not looking at.
And this robbery scene, I think Bryan Singer has a great way of staging the action in this. It's very low-key action. It's very low-budget action. But blocking in the police car with vans on all sides, smashing the window, and I can't say enough good things about John Ottman's score on this film and the way that it's just got this ticking to it. I really found myself adrenalized during the robbery scene.
I can't praise every action scene in this, but I really do like this one. This is the one that kind of really pulled me in. If I like that lineup scene and I'm like, okay, even though this is the best cast, like there's some good characters here. I like this heist. It's not the biggest heist. I also found it funny, like we're going to do it nonviolently, which still means we're all going to pull out guns and may have to shoot them. But okay, it's a good scene. It's a good setup, blocking them in with those vans and everything and then setting it on fire because we'll find out, yeah, they also want revenge against the New York cops for pulling them all in the first place. So let's expose this taxi service they have.
And I think Keaton just wants revenge because he used to be on this force and maybe feels, I don't know, does he feel like he still should be there even though he was a criminal? I mean, I don't think he's saying that he didn't do all the things that they were investigating him for.
No, I think he did all of them.
Yes, exactly. But he just, it's not played like he wants that vengeance, but that's probably why he agreed to do the job, at least in part, is that I want to stick it to the outfit that threw me away.
Yeah, they're all corrupt too, yet he's the one that got fired.
And that's worth pointing out. That's always a fun thing about noir, is that the cops are just as bad as the criminals. Again, you have these two cops that are profiting off driving the smuggler through town. Yeah, we don't feel bad for them going down. It's a world where everyone is guilty, and I guess that means just because Keaton has higher aspirations, we should want him to succeed. It's always the impossible dream to escape the criminal underworld, but we know that's not possible because the first scene told us he's going to end up on a boat getting shot.
And I never really root for him to leave the criminal underworld. The restauranteur business does not seem cool, and being with these other guys doing this kind of a job seems cool. Much like a Tarantino film, you like the gangsters, and you don't want to see them go straight. That would be boring.
Yeah, and boring this movie is not. One thing I want to emphasize is they just keep things moving. I don't know that this is the best action or the best cinematography. Sometimes it really shows the seams of its $6 million budget, but it just, there's always something new happening, and it's jumping around in time. We're just always being asked to pay attention, and for me, that's a lot of fun. That's engaging to be invited to always ask, where are we now? How did we get here?
And much of this is done with voiceover from Kevin Spacey, and we keep going back to Kevin Spacey and Chaz Palminteri in that police station doing their interview there. And I think that's wonderful glue that helps it to jump around and feel cohesive.
Right. And again, this is where you get into reliable narrators. This is more or less the story that Verbal Kent told the DA last night. And it was really weird because the DA got involved, the mayor got involved, the governor, all these political people already came in and said, this guy, he's untouchable. And all Chaz Palminteri is trying to do is to get a detail that's not already on an official sanitized transcript. He calls bullshit. He's like, Verbal, I don't believe that the man you're describing is Keaton. I believe you're covering for him. He has faked his death before, and you're helping him do that now. So tell me more. This is where Verbal starts looking around the room. This is where Verbal starts taking things from the blackboard and just the manufacturer of the coffee cup in Palminteri's hands.
It's so obvious when you know the twist. Like, yeah, he's holding that coffee cup and Spacey just staring at the bottom of it to see the brand.
He's like, okay, you want more story? I will manufacture that for you. But this is where we start to get the next heist. And how much is true? Obviously, there's a boat that's on fire. So some of this is true. But did most of this happen? Or did most of this just come from the brain of somebody that is bullshitting?
I had that thought while watching it this time, is because what we are seeing is reenactments of Verbal story, and we're going to find out Verbal made up a ton of shit. Now, did he just change the names to protect the innocent? Or is this entirely a fabrication? Fortunately, the film's entertaining enough that that almost doesn't matter.
Yeah, no, I'll say the first time I watched this, it did matter, and that was my negative reaction, was, oh, so you just wasted 2 hours of my time with a made-up story, may as well say it was all a dream, and that's why I had such a strong negative reaction to this film, is I didn't like the idea that you just showed me some guy make up a story for the last 2 hours.
Yeah, nobody likes that ending. The season of Dallas, the television show that pissed off all the highest-rated show, and then they just go, oh, that whole last season was Bobby's dream. You can't fuck with people like that. They will resent it. I will say part of the game is still trying to verify what might be true from the story by looking at the other investigators. It cuts back to Giancarlo, and he's still talking to the Hungarian who's saying Kaiser Soze. So there is somebody masquerading in that trench coat and that hat that was on that boat. So some of this did happen the way that Verbal is laying it out.
Yeah, it feels like Verbal is never going to bring up Kaiser Soze until that gets dropped from the Hungarian in the hospital. Huon's going to come in and go, oh, Kaiser Soze. And then Kevin Spacey is going to really overact in shock to that name.
And of course, part of that is he is Kaiser Soze and is not wanting to tip people off. But the way he'll spin it is that I kept that out of the official transcript because if Kaiser finds out that I'm naming him, he'll whack me. And we have this, again, what I really call like this mythical figure that no matter where you go, the all-knowing, I mean, it's what we fear. And it's, quite frankly, often the villain of bad Hollywood B-movies, the criminal that knows everything and knows what you're doing and is always having you under surveillance.
But they even play with that because they call him the boogeyman that criminals tell their children about. You know, be good or Kaiser Soze will come and get you. They're poking fun at that stereotype while at the same time creating this boogeyman.
Yeah, I want to ask, do you guys experience Kaiser as a horrific devil or as a figure of satire and comedy? For me, it's more fun to see this as semi-supernatural.
Yeah, I'll say because this Hungarian had seen him, I assumed, oh, this is a real character. But when we're told this story, like, about Kaiser's rise to notoriety, like, that does feel like just a made-up story to scare people. Like, the fact that there wasn't an eyewitness, I would be more on the side that all this stuff is just made up. And, yeah, it's this fictional entity, a boogeyman, like you said.
Yeah, I always just believed him to be the criminal he's depicted to be just this ruthless killer.
You wouldn't believe in him.
Yeah. What undermines it when I watched it this time is the fact that all he really is a drug kingpin. What he really is, as described by Kobayashi, is one of the biggest cocaine dealers in the States. It's like, I like to think of him as involved in all kinds of crime, you know?
Well, he is. I feel like the fact that Verbal has all these pardons or immunities or whatever from the mayor, like, that feels like Soze has all these connections, that he is everywhere.
Yeah, the devil cut a million deals. He's not just caring about Mickey Rourke and Lisa Bonet. Like, every single person gets made an offer, and therefore, yeah, he has amazing friends that can really deliver for him. But the reason why our five suspects find out about him is that they go to L.A. to fence the emeralds they stole and are put on a new job. That, of course, you can't just have one final job. There's always something else. And Keaton gets talked into going after another jeweler who is at an underground parking lot, supposedly with money they can keep and jewels they can give the fence, but turns out it's just holding a bunch of cocaine. And this was all a setup by Soze.
Another good action scene. This is the scene where Stephen Baldwin's going to kill two guys with pistols. He's holding them the right way. This has the 90s cliche of a lot of times guys are going to hold their guns sideways. But here, McManus is going to hold the pistols right and track two guys who each of them has a human shield, and that's not enough to stop this sharpshooter.
It might be Hockney. There is one of them that does hold their gun sideways. I noticed that. I was wondering if that was going to be a giveaway to who Soze was or something.
Yeah, because Soze kept his gun sideways, and we're going to see a lot of sideways guns in this movie.
But this is the scene, like, I just wrote down, is this too funny? This feels like it's too Tarantino when McManus takes out these two guys at the same time.
Wearing a Confederate hat cap, and again, they do a lot to just, you know, it was the time to instigate. You're going to, this movie is not un-PC, but it's going to celebrate tough guys who care nothing about political correctness. So they're going to try to get under your skin the way Tarantino using the N-word does. And again, to me, that feels like posturing. That doesn't feel real. I don't see real people doing this. I see a screenwriter that is trying to build up myth for all these characters. And sometimes it looks silly.
And as you mentioned, there's no jewels, there's no cash, there's a briefcase full of drugs. And the guy who they're robbing won't hand it over. Verbal, who was all about nonviolence in the last one, is going to shoot this guy in the head. And that's a clue that Verbal is Kaiser Soze. Because what you're going to find out is Kaiser wanted this guy dead. It's later going to be said by Kobayashi, the lawyer, my employer thanks you. That is a most unexpected benefit. And Verbal, why would he shoot this guy so cold-bloodedly like that? On repeat viewings, it makes sense.
Well, let's dig in deeper, because I'm not sure it does. He shoots this guy because he doesn't feel like Keaton is going to pull the trigger. Keaton is close to it, but keep in mind, Keaton's been like, I don't want to do another job, and He even told the guy that set him up with the job that he killed his drug dealer as a way of getting thrown off the job. And Byrne is just giving you the energy of someone that is not a killer. And so if the plot of this really is a master criminal wants to get some guys to kill a man for him, why would he go with a guy that is slow to pull the trigger?
Or why is he with this group at all? Like, you're putting yourself real close to danger.
Yeah. Why are these the people I use?
And this is where, I don't know, I use that Transformer logic maybe and roll out. Like, I'm having a good time with this crime film. Like you said, Stuart, it moves. It throws a lot in front of you. Yeah, there are questions. And maybe it's telling that I'm not going to take it too seriously, where I'm willing to just have more fun with it than get bogged down with all these questions. I'm looking into them, but I'm not going to get too worried about all the logic working out. It never does in these kind of films.
Right, yeah. It's just the difference between, like, an intense noir movie where you bought into, like, wow, and one that's just a lot of fun. I don't want to sound like a hater. I just want people to understand the difference as to why I consider this movie light and fluffy and not on the same level as, like, a great noir movie.
See, and I think that this is tighter than you guys are giving it credit for. I think that the reasons are there. I think the more you watch this film, the more it coheres.
No, people aren't saying the motivations. I get the motivations are very meticulously worked out. There's no depth to this story. It's all just fun. You know, it's all just cons within cons.
It could have been job after job after job, and I wouldn't have cared, but it wouldn't have meant anything.
It's like a rocky road or a, you know, a swirl of different flavors that are fun to eat, but there's no there, is what I'm saying. It doesn't really make sense that a criminal mastermind would fuck with five guys this way. It doesn't really make sense. It's just fun.
I think his plot does come through. I think his revenge plot works in his favor. He succeeds with this, so.
But he ends up killing the guy anyway. He never needed any of these guys to do what he did. It's just his own form of entertainment, I guess. Or, I'm going to ask this, is there something about the way they've ripped him off that gets him mad? Because the way this all comes out is, after the job goes south, they go back to the fence. He's like, yeah, talk to Kobayashi. And they put him in a billiard room. And all of a sudden, we got Pete Postlethwaite, the most Irish pale man I can think of, wearing brown face and speaking in pidgin English. And again, this is what I mean about the non-PC. It's not like the movie thinks you're going to fall for that. It reveals itself in the moment as a ruse. Obviously, this guy is not Kobayashi. But that creates the idea of games within games.
I honestly thought this guy was some kind of Middle Eastern. I thought the accent was real.
Pete Postlethwaite? In the Name of the Father? You don't know this actor?
No, never seen In the Name of the Father.
I mean, I think he's in Braveheart. I think he was in Patriot Games. Like, we've talked about him before.
Yeah, he's definitely from the UK, like, in a big way. And there's no missing that. But I guess if you don't know, and I'm hearing you say, a lot of these people are not people that I had watched films work from before I saw this film, you wouldn't guess the game then. You would just think that this is a Japanese lawyer working for someone that also has an exotic sounding name. And it really sends you to the idea that these are darker people and couldn't possibly be pasty Kevin Spacey.
Yeah, I mean, the name Kobayashi, I'm of course thinking Kobayashi Maru from Star Trek 2, and I never took him as Asian, but they keep talking about Hungary and Hungarians, and Kaiser Soze sounds like a Middle Eastern kind of name to me, so I just took him as some kind of Eurasian.
No, I recognized the actor right away, so I'm like, okay, this is just a ruse to throw people off.
And this is the games that Macquarie and Singer are playing, is that, yes, the inference of the names we're dropping will lead you down a path that isn't necessarily true. You may be looking at Burns as the one pulling all the strings because he looks like he won't pull any strings. Or you may, yes, this obvious Irish actor playing Japanese should have you, I don't know, yes, thinking that this is not on the level when he says, I work for Kaiser Soze. And by the way, throughout your criminal histories, you all have betrayed him and owe him this job. You need to do this final thing of going to the boat. The thing we know from the beginning will get them all killed. And this is where we see them really meditate. Like, Del Toro, he really believes the myth. This guy is, like, a super criminal. I believe that. And Kevin Pollak is like, nah, this is the cops trying to set him up. Kevin Spacey says, I've never heard of the guy. Of course, what else is he going to say? He is the guy. He's a con man.
But also, he's not one of the criminals. He's kind of our point of view character. They have to explain everything to Verbal so that they can explain it to us.
Does he have any real beef with Keaton? Is there some reason why he wants this guy whacked? Or is he just a pawn to use?
That's why I'm wondering, does he know Q-On has his heart on for Keaton, thinking that he has faked his death before and all that, so he could just push this myth on him?
Is he jealous of somebody that's making similar moves? Like, oh, you think you can stage your death, but you don't know how to really play the game? Does he not want to see this guy go legit? Nothing ever comes out in all my viewings of this that tell me that there's a secret grudge between the two.
The only thing we have is that in 1981, Keaton hijacked a truck in New York. It had raw steel in it that was Kaiser Soze, is going to be used in a nuclear reactor. And just like everybody else, they didn't know they were stealing from Soze, and Keaton stole from Soze.
Yeah, but so why keep baiting this guy? I'm sure everyone has betrayed Soze if you're working at that level.
If you do worldwide crime.
Yes, if you're involved in every crime, then everybody owes you. Why does he seem to want to keep tempting this guy who keeps saying, I want to go legit? And it's only because, really, it's Verbal that gets him to join the jobs. It's almost like Soze / Verbal really needs this guy's soul particularly.
Yeah, it felt like Keaton's a big deal.
Is it because Kuyan's going to try to pin everything on Keaton anyway, and so it helps cover him up?
Do you really need that? Again, if all you're doing is whacking somebody that saw you, one dude, this is way too elaborate.
Yeah, you could have just whacked him.
Yeah, I mean, he does. He just walks in and kills him. It should be said, while all of this shenanigans is going on, that's exactly what Kaiser Soze does. But let's get to it. So they don't want to take this job. They're like, Kobayashi, we need to whack him. They come to that conclusion after Benicio Del Toro tries to walk away and ends up dead on a beach.
Yeah, anytime they're pulling a crime, I really enjoy the vibe of this film and the plot to pretend that they're maintenance men and infiltrate this building and put a gun to Kobayashi's head is another good one. But Kaiser Soze or Kobayashi has a leg up because, as you mentioned, Keaton has a girlfriend, this lawyer, and Kobayashi brought her out to LA to help with an extradition matter. So she's already there with a couple of guys that are going to kill her if anything happens to Kobayashi.
Yeah, and so that requires you to believe that Keaton loves this woman and needs the straight life that she's offering, that he sees in his future he can't be with another woman.
Which I'm just getting all through inference, because there is no scenes establishing, like, he really loves this woman, that he's into this marriage.
That scene where he's like, I want to say goodbye, and they have to get on the plane. It's there, but
it's barely there.
Yeah. Do you believe it? Does it matter? It doesn't matter for the level of commitment this movie is asking. It would matter if I was deeply involved in this tragedy.
The problem is, there's no big scenes between Susie Amos and Gabriel Byrne to show me this love. We see them separate. We see longing looks from Gabriel Byrne. There's the one scene where they're walking out of the police station and she's angry and she's going to defend him, but
she loves him. She wasn't just angry. She kept telling him, I love you, I love you. And he kept looking at the other guys and being like, should I do that job?
I mean, one of the films I kept thinking of when they were telling me I should be invested in Keaton and his wife and all that was another crime film that, Stuart, you thought was probably too much praised, is Heat, where, like, I praise that because I like that it got into all those kind of relationships with the criminals and their significant others. And, like, I felt that was the strong point to that film. And, yeah, watching this one in contrast, where it's like, yeah, we don't care about any of that stuff. We're just going to tell you it's important.
Yeah, I was definitely thinking of Heat with this relationship and the way you are supposed to leave the woman if the heat's around the corner. And does Gabriel Byrne really love this woman? The dialogue tells me yes. The performance tells me maybe.
Yeah, and these are cliches. Again, Heat is a movie that also builds off of posturing, and posturing is cool. It can be fun. I think it can be very seductive to see archetypes of masculinity. But again, a deeper experience pulls me in more emotionally, and I'm just not emotionally invested in Keaton or any of these guys. It's just fun to watch them. Oh, now we're in the elevator and we're pretending to, you know, that we can whack this Kobayashi. And he's as cool a customer as they come. He's like, with guns in his face, he's like, oh, one more thing. Why don't we go upstairs and I'll show you that I have your girlfriend under watch. That makes me like Kobayashi. It doesn't make me care about Keaton and the trap he's falling into.
I love the chess game, though. I love the one-upsmanship. I love that we get Baldwin here, McManus saying, I'm the one that's going to get you to Kobayashi. And nope, he's not going to be, but you think he is. You think that these are a bunch of tough guys who are going to... I know we saw the boat scene at the beginning, but I'm not thinking it. I'm thinking these guys will find a way to prevail because they seem like a very good commando unit.
I'm pretty sure you see McManus dead in that opening shot. When the fire is trailing across the dock, there's a body that looks pretty much like McManus and will prove to be McManus. Some viewers might have observed that and have that in their head that these guys are dead. I also just think it's that kind of movie, Reservoir Dogs. If you saw that movie, you know that this crew is going to meet a similar fate. Death hangs over them, just like Kaiser Soze hangs over them. He is the specter of death. He is Michael Myers. He is going to get them.
But I'm here for this Shaggy Dog tale as we go from crime to crime, you know, as we get closer to this boat heist. Like, I am invested in this as a crime film.
Very much so. And I'm surprised that there's still over a half an hour of movie left when they start the boat heist. Because I'm like, the boat is the climax of the film, and there's still a lot of film left.
Well, again, it's because we keep jumping around in time, because we keep cutting back, and we get Kevin Spacey giving a story that is way too overheated, right? Like, it's eye-rolling to hear this, like, Kaiser Soze, he came home, and when they had his family at gunpoint, he shot his family first just to show these guys how tough he is. I mean, that is not true. That's where you go, okay, this guy is full of it.
Oh, I figured that story was true.
Yeah, it's such a great story just to scare people, even if it's not true. Here's my thing. I just wish this scene was shot better. This is where you really see the seams of this budget. It's this like hazy, dreamlike scene where it doesn't even feel like people are really moving. Like, I just wish they would have shot this scene as if it was actually happening. It would have been so much more impactful than this really cheesy soap opera way they portray it.
Yeah, and they did that on purpose. That was a in-camera effect, not a post-production effect. And they really wanted this to have a dreamlike quality. When you see this guy with long hair walking away from big flames, it reminded me of Antonio Banderas in Desperado. The fact that, yeah, how is Kaiser Soze supposed to be Kevin Spacey and have this gloriously long Fabio hair?
Yeah, is this a cheat? Do they go too far by casting a different actor who only, again, through beer goggles, I think they literally shot it through beer goggles, have this criminal. We see him in his face. He's flicking his cigarette. This is Spacey in a different era. I guess, you know, people lose their hair. Kevin Spacey probably had a long mane in the 70s. But yeah, is this a cheat to say that both are the same?
Well, my question is, should they have ripped off Reservoir Dogs even more? Because I'm enjoying this film a lot more knowing the twists, seeing the ironies and all that. So the fact that, yeah, do you reveal like Tim Roth halfway through that he's not who he has said he is? So maybe that it makes more sense that he's trying to build up this myth and they're using a different actor with long, glorious locks to portray his younger self. I don't know. I would like to toy with this screenplay a bit more to see if there's a better way to handle this reveal and all the Kaiser Soze stuff.
I love that the reveal comes at the end. It's just such a mind-blowing twist for me. It's, you know.
What else would they end with, Jacob? This is the movie. It is all about that ending. You would have no ending if you put the ending in the middle.
See, I'm having so much fun knowing the twist and seeing Spacey's character play everyone, go on all these crime heists. Like, I'm having fun with the tall tale that Spacey's telling us that, like, yeah, I could have done with this revelation coming a little bit earlier and being played different. That's what turned me off of this film. I hated the fact that I just sat through a 2-hour campfire story.
I do agree that a second viewing is maybe necessary, but also fun. I don't think that seeing it once ruins watching it again. You want to see how you got conned. It's funny to see Kevin Spacey under pressure here, trying to figure it out, trying to keep his cool. Yeah, but I just see in no world can I imagine them actually revealing he's Sosei and then having a dramatic ending. I don't know what that could possibly be.
Yeah, especially since when I watched this the first time, hey, I was barely 20 years old. I was not being an active viewer. I was being a very passive viewer. But I didn't even think Kaiser Soze was one of them. I just thought Kaiser Soze was somebody else who was out there, you know, like the Emperor in Star Wars, referenced but not seen. And so I wouldn't have liked that reveal in the middle. But I also think it's a testament to the screenwriting and the acting that it's more fun to rewatch this film again and again and watch these things once you know the twist. It is not a film that lives and dies by the twist. I did have a, oh, damn, moment when I found out the twist, but then I immediately watched it again and liked the film even more, as you say, Jacob, knowing it.
Well, let me tweak that a bit. Everything is predicated on Spacey being the person you didn't think was Kaiser Soze. You take that out of the script, there isn't a movie here. It is the fact that you're watching the movie for the details about how you might have known that, how he's pulling strings, but at no point is that an irrelevant detail. That is the movie.
I disagree. I think that that's the twist, but that's not the movie, because to me, Kaiser Soze could be Marcellus Wallace, just a criminal, badass kingpin who's out there and who will go medieval on your ass if you rob from him, and he didn't have to be one of this crew.
But then what is the movie?
Yeah, I'm going to agree with Stuart that at some point Soze has to like show up and do something. Like, it can't just be some background character that they referenced at some point.
Yeah, I mean, it's only because Soze has assembled them all, has been tracking them and using them from the beginning. Since 1981, apparently, this plot is being hatched. So, yeah, how could he not be not important? How do you reduce his importance by saying it's about something else? This is not a guy movie. This is not just about bros hanging out and being funny with each other like Reservoir Dogs. It is about them trying to keep their composure as death closes in for them. And that death is Kaiser Soze.
Who I knew was on the boat. We got that in the opening scene. But I didn't necessarily take that to mean he was one of them. He could have just, again, like Marcellus Wallace, been in charge and then finally show up.
Yeah, I mean, you could definitely make the movie and maybe some members of the audience, probably lots of people in the audience are just thinking this is a phantom that will never be caught. Maybe actually, again, Robert De Niro with glowing red eyes, the devil, is on here on the boat. I mean, I do think Spacey sells that in the way that he looks fearful. And again, that's why he didn't put it in his official testimony with the DA, is that he doesn't want that name and his name to be connected. And this is where, yeah, we're really getting into the climax. It's this game where Palminteri is leaning harder and harder on Keaton. So where was Keaton? Why does Keaton ask Verbal to hang back while they go in with guns blazing? What was the point of that if not to hide the fact that he was, so say, you know, this wasn't about a drug deal. We've had established at this point, we've had enough scenes of them exploring the boat and all, and to realize that it wasn't at all how Kobayashi pitched it. This is not Argentinians selling Hungarians dope. This is Argentinians delivering to Hungarians the one man that can help them find the guy that killed that whole cartel, that Hungarian cartel from Verbal's story.
I don't know. You could call me ableist, but I don't know if I'd tell Verbal to come storm the ship with me when he could barely walk. Like, yeah, that's someone you kind of just have hang out in the back and get any strays.
And pity. Again, he's used that pity thing.
And you're supposed to believe, again, that Keaton loved his girlfriend, because what he tells Verbal is, get the money, get it to my girlfriend, make sure she's okay and protected from Kaiser Soze.
And of course, she's already dead, as Palminteri will lord over Verbal in the interrogation scenes. I know she's dead and she's not even in LA. And so he's not this romantic you portray. What you are describing in your story is not the guy that I've been chasing for 3 years. And that's the power play standoff as they keep going through. And as they cut into the ship, it should be said, Gabriel Byrne is starting to look more fearsome. He is down in the bowels with a weapon, glowering the best that he can glower. And we see that Arturo guy hiding in a room. He very well could be Soze coming to kill him.
The one who I love during the scene, Stephen Baldwin McManus, shooting 7 guys in a couple of seconds. Oswald had a decent shot at a good distance, but yeah, McManus could have obviously done even better. Doesn't need a magic bullet to take out JFK. He could do it with a regular bullet.
Here's what I'll ask. Would you like to see this crew do a different job with no Kaiser Soze around their neck?
Yeah, I like the interplay between them, especially before Benicio dies. I would have just enjoyed a film with these 5 guys doing fun crime.
And I disagree. The fact that Soze is the danger, that they keep getting roped into job after job after job and it's gone out of control, that's the fun for me, not this group of guys just doing crimes.
Yeah, again, the fun for me is the mixing of the genres. You got a horror story and a noir story coming together. That's the fun. And again, the dance of, like, where are we? We keep hopping around in time. We're back at the boat. Who could it be? They're leading us towards one person, and it can't be him because we think that he's been shot. We see that Verbal is watching from the side of the boat as this guy in a trench coat shoots Gabriel Byrne, puts a axe or something, knife, I believe it was, switchblade maybe, in the back of McManus's head.
I thought it was a hammer, but yeah, some implement.
They're all dead.
I love McManus's death, too, when he comes out. He's just like, it's the strangest thing. And then he falls over. He was dying the whole time. Of course, Hockney has a good death, too. Kevin Pollak is trying to get the money, and he goes and gets shot, and he just turns around to see who killed him. He gets to see the face of Kaiser Soze as he dies, and they just wash it out. They overexpose the film, and as he dies, he's going into the light, I suppose.
You know, Robert Richardson was a big cinematographer pushing that. A lot of Oliver Stones had that heavy, heavy, bright top light. It was an aesthetic of the 90s. I don't think that the cinematographer is doing it as well, but, you know, it reminds me of the 90s. I'll say that, Arnie. It looks like a 90s movie. Anyway, let's get to the twist. We keep talking about it. We've already spoiled it. I believe, probably like Psycho, most people that approach Usual Suspects at this moment, I would guess, would know that Verbal Kent has been playing this guy the whole time, laying low, and now just needs to get the hell out of there. Like, he actually, this could blow up on his face if he doesn't, you know, recognize, you can't hold me anymore. I got to get out of here, grab my lighter, and become a different phantom.
Okay, this is still a problem for me. Like, that Hungarian in the hospital saw him. They have a sketch artist at the beginning when Giancarlo Esposito is there. Like, they're like, get a sketch artist. Like, he saw him. And at some point, like, Verbal says, it's been like 90 minutes I've been here. Like, they've had time to draw that sketch and fax it over. Like, faxes aren't that slow.
They are.
And sketch artists and the translator, you know, the Hungarian is speaking in Hungarian, and so he has to speak to a translator who's speaking to the sketch artist.
It's been a couple hours. I'm not buying it.
I am. I'm not going to pick that nit.
What do you mean by not buying it? You're not buying it as in that this is not realistic? Well, guess what? Nothing we've been watching is realistic.
No, where I feel like that's stretching it, like where it's like, oh, we got to have our big reveal, so we're going to like make this thing real drawn out. No pun intended, I guess.
I mean, the devil's a procrastinator is what I would say. Like, he's really cutting it close.
Well, the fact that he limps for so long outside to get to the car, I'm like, dude, just walk regular. You're out of view of the cops.
He's doing it for us. You have to realize this is all for the audience. As it dawns across the wave of people that, you know, and I think it's going to hit people at different moments. Some people might have known all along. I don't know if you can figure it out before you get here. I know I never did. But certainly, by the time that Chaz Palminteri is looking around the office and realizing details from Verbal story are all over the place, that would have one thinking that he was lying. And certainly, yeah, the sketch artist reveal tells you, literally says, the man that was identified on the boat as Kaiser is Kevin Spacey, without a doubt.
Blew my mind the first time I saw it. When that foot goes straight and then he flexes his hand and shows he could the entire time, wow, I felt the floor go out from underneath me the first time. Just this and Fight Club are the two movies that blew my mind the most with their twists, I do think.
Yeah, it's a twist movie. It is about this twist. I mean, I will insist on that. Now, however much you've enjoyed every minute of this movie, it is all building to this moment, and without this moment in this movie, there is no movie. So it is about the twist, and it is a good twist. I do believe it really works. It really plays, and it rewards you for however detailed you've followed the movie, whether casually or rewound and written down every line of dialogue. I still think it's very rewarding to get to this moment. And that he's getting a car ride from, all air quotes around Kobayashi. We'll never know this guy's name. I don't think he's wearing brown face anymore. But they're partners in crime. They do this for a living. The devil has an ally. And they're off to create a new identity and presumably, I don't know, I guess you could have a sequel, right? You would obviously be a building to a different twist, but you could have Kevin Spacey manipulate new criminals. Might be kind of fun.
Yeah, or the hunt for Kaiser Soze now that they have a sketch and know this verbal kint, you know, the cops closing in on Kaiser.
Nah, Chaz Palminteri is not someone I want to follow into the sequel. Again, I've wanted better actors this whole time. You want a new cool crew. You want younger, hipper. Maybe he is the devil. Maybe he hasn't aged in all this time and he looks, well, maybe he's grown his hair out again. Who knows? But you could do it. You could actually requel this and do it all again, building to a new twist with Kevin Spacey trapping a new crew.
Well, you couldn't now, not with Kevin Spacey trapping a new crew.
I mean, again, he might be able to work with it. You know what I mean? Again, like, it was hard to believe. It was shocking to believe that Kevin Spacey was a killer when you got to the end of Seven or you got to the end of this movie. But not so much anymore.
Yeah, you're just expecting it now.
Mm-mm, yeah, exactly. It's when he tries to be wholesome.
Pay It Forward does not play the same.
Yeah, right. Beyond the Sea is the one I go to, where he's Bobby Darin. But
So, Jacob, Stewart, do you recommend The Usual Suspects? Jacob.
Like I said, I went in skeptical because my memory of this film was it's got a twist, and I really didn't like it. Like, it really put me off of the whole film. So I was interested in coming back to it and giving it another chance. And I'll say I really enjoyed it this time. Like we said, it's not the deepest film. It's a twist movie. Like, that's its central conceit. I would have, you know, you could still have the chess game, the cat and mouse. I love the line in retrospect, knowing the twist when Q-On's like, I'm so much smarter than you. And we're like, we know that's a joke now because he's getting fooled this whole time. So there's fun stuff like that, watching it when you know the twist. And I think it was a more rewarding experience. But yeah, I wish it was a better cast, maybe better director, cinematographer, all that stuff. Score, you love the score, Arnie. I'll give that to you. But like, when you have Tarantino and Guy Ritchie doing like the best crime films during this time, this one, it's pretty good. Like, I definitely am going to recommend this film. I had a fun time watching it as just this crazy crime heist that spins out of control and the stakes just get more and more as it goes on. I liked all that stuff. That's a lot of fun here. There's definitely criticisms that we've made throughout it, but this is a fun time. I like a good crime film, and yeah, this is a good crime film. You'll enjoy yourself with this one. Recommend.
Stuart.
Yeah, I think Spacey uses the right terminology. Usual Suspects is a great trick. It's a trick, and I love getting fooled. It's really fun to see. And not enough people really do bring the horror elements into noir in the way that this movie blends. And I definitely, again, believe Kevin Spacey could be the literal devil. He comes off that way. And some of that is the performance he gives. Some of that is the meta knowledge we have now. But what I'm going to say is I recommend this movie, and I feel like what people want to hear is, why don't you highly recommend this movie? Like, I need to speak to why I'm not in love with this movie and just saying you'll have a good time watching it. So again, let me get back to that word trick. When you see a guy saw a woman in half, when you see a magician wave a cape and make the Statue of Liberty disappear, you are entertained for sure. It's a lot of fun to see that. And it's fun to see it when you know how the trick is done, maybe even more so Seeing How You Get Fooled, Usual Suspects works in all those ways. It has rewatchability. Every moment of it just carries you on a really fun ride. I am never moved. I am not invested in any of these quote-unquote cool characters. They are just posturing. And when you have a truly great noir film, be it Maltese Falcon, Chinatown, Sunset Boulevard, they play as tragedies. They break your heart because you hate watching characters fall. And I don't have that issue here. I watch Keaton go down, knowing he's going to get it from the opening scene, totally fine with it. I see Chaz Palminteri get humbled, so be it. That's whatever. Again, these are cool characters, and they facilitate a cool movie, but it's not a deep movie. And that's the difference between good and great, in my mind. That's how I can explain why Usual Suspects is just a flat recommend and not the classic that some people would like to hold it up to be. So, yeah, go see the movie if you haven't, and enjoy it.
Yeah, this is one where, even though we've spoiled the hell out of the movie, again, I think rewatches are just as fun as the original watch. It's not only about the twist. You can know the twist and still get so much out of this film. I don't think we've given Chris McQuarrie enough credit for this. We've talked about the plot, but the dialogue in this film is so rich and so fun. And I write down quotes from the movie while we watch it, and oftentimes quotes that end up getting used in the credits. And I found myself transcribing this movie. I just love the dialogue so much. It's like every line is a banger.
It's funny, right? That's what you mean by saying these are great. Because I don't, again, it's not deep. I don't feel like it shows me a character I haven't seen before. They just say off-the-cuff things that may shock or amuse you.
And I don't feel like this is one of those films that get quoted all the time like a Tarantino film might.
It does have the line, "The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist," which I didn't realize is actually from a French poet. It's not from Chris McQuarrie. I always thought it was from Chris McQuarrie.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah, I figured it was from like C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters or something. It sounds like something he'd write in his Christian stuff.
But I think that the lines here are cool. You know, you want to talk about Tarantino, and what does Tarantino sell? He sells cool. And I think that this movie rides on a lot of cool. I think that the Usual Suspects, the five guys, are cool. I think that their interplay is incredible to watch. I think that together, they are stronger than individual actors. I think that the chemistry here pops off the screen. I think that this is a film I will hold up there. I honestly felt like when I was rewatching this and I was ruminating on this for this review, I'm like, could this honestly be to the latter part of the 20th century what Citizen Kane is to the early part of the 20th century?
No.
Is it that great a film? I think it is.
I want to be clear. You think Citizen Kane is the greatest film of the first half of the century?
It's highly regarded as that, and I greatly respect that film.
No. We're talking about you. No one thinks that this movie is as good as Citizen Kane except you. No one. Not even Christopher McQuarrie.
I really like Citizen Kane a lot. I like The Usual Suspects more.
Okay, and great. I get that. But you get what I'm saying.
I hear what you're saying, and I understand what you're saying.
Cool is superficial. You can be cool and not very deep. In fact, that's usually how it goes. Like, a deeper movie is a more impressive movie. Something that can go to depths of emotion. This movie just stays at cool.
I feel like there's emotion here because I care about the characters. I care about each of them individually. I definitely mourn when Benicio del Toro is taken out of the film because he is my favorite.
I mean, we all do. He's the best character.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mourn it, but I miss him. And, you know, again, I talked about horror noir. I don't think this movie looks as good as Angel Heart. You know what I mean? Like, it's not a great looking movie.
Oh, I think it's really good. I love the camera work. I love the camera movement in this. I really think Newton Thomas Siegel does a great job in filming this.
Citizen Kane level.
Maybe not Citizen Kane level filmography, because Citizen Kane is a gorgeous looking film.
Yeah, we might have to do Citizen Kane if you keep talking like this.
So this is a strong, strong recommend. And again, it's, I've heard what you guys said, and it's tinted my recommend here a little bit, because I was going to come in here and call this a perfect movie. The things you guys have pointed out, maybe not a perfect movie, but a really, I'll use the word, great movie. and one that I can't recommend strongly enough, and one of my favorite films. It holds up. I was worried coming back to it. Would I still like it? Would I like it as much? And it was like visiting an old friend and just falling back into an old rapport that you have with an old friend. I can't stay away from this film so long again next time. It's just too good a movie for me not to revisit at least once every 5 years.
I'll say it's a win, because before, if you would have mentioned this movie, I would have just like laughed and like, oh, that's a silly movie. It's dumb. It's not worth your time. And like, no, it's a fun time. Like, yeah, watch this film. I've come around to it.
I'm reminded of Pauline Kael. She said that great movies rarely are perfect, that the film that doesn't have flaws is not the ones we most love. The ones that touch us, I mean, I think that's why it's interesting to talk about movies, because ultimately, you're kind of talking about yourself as well. What you're drawn to, what you find compelling. Again, I get it. I see the appeal of this movie. It got a lot to offer. I think a lot of people will like it. But yeah, to me, it's not a great noir because it doesn't, it just stays on that surface of cool and doesn't go below it. And again, we've talked about great noirs. Maybe we'll talk about them next week, because we've got David Fincher, director of Seven, coming back with his new movie straight to Netflix. This is kind of weird, right? What a coup for Netflix. They got David Fincher's latest thriller, bypassing theaters.
I mean, I don't know. They had his last film, Mank, and that wasn't good.
Yeah, stank. I'll say it. I didn't like it at all. But I always want to watch his work. They're always beautiful to look at. And this film looks cool. Definitely looks cool. Tilda Swinton, Michael Fassbender, French comic book assassin. I'm down.
So that's for our killer level donors or our patrons of $50 or more next week. Or you can get it one off in our patron digital store. So that will be available next Friday. Thank you, though, for your support at the monthly $10 or more level. We greatly appreciate the support you are providing right now. Not trying to upsell, just telling you what's coming next week if you're one of those level patrons or donors.
And I declare, what's coming next month has really got my panties in a bunch. December is another day for Now Playing, because someone really thought we had something to offer about Gone with the Wind. I'm not playing. They really, that 4-hour movie, I mean, I only saw it once, and I never thought I'd see it again, but here it comes.
I saw it once as well.
I just want you to be Foghorn Leghorn through the whole thing.
Yeah. I don't know about this movie. I'll be honest. There's kind of like a film snob war between Casablanca versus Gone with the Wind. I'm always team Casablanca. I didn't like Gone with the Wind, but we'll see. It's obviously an important, giant epic, and is worth consideration. I will be diving in with you, Arnie, and Brock at the end of the year. I think it's the last show of 2023.
So we hope you can join us for that just by staying a patron. And thanks again to Sean Ray for supporting us as much as you do and picking The Usual Suspects. Loved getting the chance to watch this. I just don't get a chance to rewatch a lot of movies because I'm watching a lot of movies for Now Playing. If I'm rewatching a movie, it's usually because we're reviewing it. And so the chance to watch this, one of the highlights of my year was rewatching The Usual Suspects. Not been a great year for me, but this is one of the highlights of my year.
Or you just really like this film, which it sounds like.
Both can be true. And Jacob Stewart, thank you for joining me. And like that, we were gone.
You think you can catch Kaiser Soze? You think a guy like that comes this close to getting caught and sticks his head out? If he comes up for anything, it'll be to get rid of me. After that, my guess is you'll never hear from him again.
Once again, thank you for supporting Now Playing, and we hope you've enjoyed this bonus movie review.
I'll tell you what I know. Stop me when this sounds familiar.
And a special thank you to Sean Ray for his incredible support of our show and for picking The Usual Suspects for our hosts to review.
I'm telling you, the sky is protected from up on high by the Prince of Darkness.
The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the views of Ngonza Media Incorporated.
These guys don't have any probable cause. then Gonza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with, and this podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created the film analyzed herein.
I mean, our rights went right out the window. It was a violation. I mean, disgraceful.
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review, and no infringement is intended.
It didn't make sense that I'd be there. I mean, these guys were hardcore hijackers. But there I was.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of and may not be used without the express written permission of Vinganza Media Incorporated.
I want my lawyer. I'm gonna have your fucking badge, cocksucker.
Now Playing is a Vinganza Media production, copyright 2023. And no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Vinganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
It's finished. I'm finished.
Bada boom, bada bing, bang, boom.
It reminds me of the 90s. I'll say that, Arnie. It looks like a 90s movie.
Hey, it's the cinematographer from Pump Up the Volume, and so he's always in my cool book.
Sure. I'm sure we'll cover that someday.
A movie known for cinematography.
Real genius. Usual Suspects is done. What else is there left but Pump Up the Volume?
I mean, Soul Man, that used to get brought up quite a bit.
Oof. I don't think we can ever do that movie.
I don't think so either. Gone with the Wind's going to be touchy enough.
Anyway, let's get to the twist. We keep talking about it. We've already spoiled it, I believe.
Bada boom, bada bing, bang, boom.